On to the fun stuff. We're back on groundfish. In fact, we're going to stay on groundfish all day. And last night, we had a motion to postpone until today, reconsideration of the emergency action petition. So, if there's someone that would like to make a motion to that effect, we'll entertain it. Otherwise, we'll move on with other business. Dr. Pierce.
Do you need a motion, Mr. Chairman? I thought we just decided to take it up today.
Okay. I'm actually not sure, so do we need a motion to begin that discussion? We would need a motion on the board, right? Is there any objection? Okay. Well, that objection. That was a groundfish committee motion, I believe, Karen. Is that correct? Does the committee chair have anything to offer on this motion or council staff?
There is a, if people haven't had a chance to look at it, there is a document number 5, which does have some of the analysis that was done by staff after the last council meeting when this was remanded back to the committee for some further investigation. I don't know if Tom has any comments that he wants to point out on that.
Tom?
Just to be clear, document 5 is not prepared by staff. It's actually prepared by the people who requested the emergency action. I did have a couple points that were mentioned at the committee meeting that I will reiterate here. One of the arguments for the emergency action in this document refers to the amount of the closed area 1 hook air haddock sap that hasn't been harvested. I just want to make sure everyone realizes that's based on the numbers that were in earlier framework documents, and those numbers were calculated before we really understood how slowly the 2003 year class of haddock was growing. We went back and looked at those projections, and just to give you an example, the 62% of the Georges Bank haddock tack in 2006, and 86%, I think that's numbers, perhaps not weight. Anyway, 82% in 2007 was expected to be produced by this 2003 year class. Well, we now know the 2003 year class did not recruit to the fishery as it was expected to in those projections. And so, you know, I would expect that these estimates of how much fish were left in the water actually overemphasize how much, overestimate how much of the tack was truly available. We saw something similar on Eastern Georges Bank haddock, where we only took two-thirds of the tack in 2006, and yet the fishing mortality exceeded the reference point in Eastern Georges Bank. I don't believe we took two-thirds of the whole Georges Bank tack, so the comparison, I'm not trying to imply that we know fishing mortality is too high on the whole Georges Bank stock. But I just want to point out that that slow growth of the year class would affect the estimates. The other thing I'd point out is that the proposed dates that they propose extending include the month of January. The Science Center has previously sent a letter to the Research Steering Committee that January through March is the time of peak spawning for cod in closed area 1. Those are the only – I mentioned those at the committee meeting, not in particular detail, but I thought I'd bring them up here.
Thanks, Tom. Anyone on the council? Dr. Pierce?
I'd like to speak in favor of the motion. The Hook Association has requested us to modify that closed area number 1 paddock special area program by extending the season to 9 months, May 1 through January 31st, expand the area to include the entire northern portion of closed area 1, and then to eliminate those seasonal and sap TAC splits between sector and non-sector vessels, and I'm not going to go into all the details. They've been provided, of course, in the letter that was just referenced by the chair and also mentioned by Tom Neese. The committee discussed the recommendation, the request, that is, made by the Hook Association, and after considerable discussion and debate, we decided to move it on. So that's the motion before us now. The request was made back in January 16. I thought, frankly, and I still think, that the request was very well done. One of the better ones I've seen. They had their problem statement, an explanation as to why they feel the proposed action meets criteria for emergency action. That, of course, might be a sticking point, always is. You know, they cite Section 305C of the Act and all the specifics regarding what does make for an emergency action. And I'm not going to read those, but the one that stands out in my mind is that emergency action is necessary when we have a serious conservation or management problem in the fishery. And I think that this is a serious management problem in the fishery. And I also believe that the other aspects of emergency action can be met as well. Some will debate that issue, but I think they have been met. Now, regarding how these emergency criteria have been met, the association, again, the Hook Association, did provide some details, many details, actually, regarding why they feel it is an emergency, and I hope that everyone has had a chance to go over them. You know, when the SAP was designed, we didn't envision that the SAP TAC would be so underutilized. Currently, according to what they have provided, they're taking just about 4% of the TAC. The SAP TAC in 2007 was 10.9 million pounds. Only 424,000 pounds were taken. That's just about 3.9%, about 4%. So I consider that to be a management problem, a serious management problem, because of that tremendous shortfall. And as a consequence of that shortfall, the request makes a great deal of sense. That is, increasing the time and the area available to this program will indeed, as they insist, as they claim, will increase opportunities for fishermen to target the healthy haddock stock, thus preserving the economic opportunity that would otherwise be lost. Now, the 2008 SAP TAC is 13.8 million pounds. It did go up considerably. Tom has just noted that that number may be too high. We have other considerations now, the slow-growing haddock stock that might, when additional calculations are made down the road, might indicate that the TAC actually should be lower than that. Nevertheless, even if it is lowered, according to the proposers, to those who have requested the Hook Association, they predict that only about 300 metric tons will be caught in 2008. That means they'll be foregoing about 6,000 metric tons. Let's say they forego 4,000 metric tons or 3,000 metric tons. There's still a lot of yield that will not be taken because of the projected very low catch from the SAP this year. So current participants and then new participants that would be brought about by this request, they would lose that TAC. That's tremendous foregone yield, haddock yield, and that will continue to add to all the foregone yield that we've had in the haddock fishery now, such as the fishery, of course, in the U.S. Canadian area. They've offered up some explanations as to why they've fallen short, why they predict that they will fall short, and why they have fallen short of taking the TAC. They mentioned a number of reasons why, and again, I'm not going to go into that, except to say that, you know, they've noted weather concerns, heavy interaction with spiny dogfish. That's taken away many of their opportunities to fish within the SAP to get their haddock catch, and this is considered by them to have been, and I agree, an unforeseen loss of opportunity. So, all right, regarding the expanded area, you know, why should the area be included? I have a couple of thoughts that I'll offer up that have led me to conclude that I should support this. Once again, the expansion is warranted due to the high haddock catch, a very low cod catch and low discards. They have provided data to make that point. I mean, this is a SAP that has been extremely successful, They have done what they said they would do, that is, target haddock and keep that cod catch very low as a consequence of the gear that they have used. They have completed 2003, 4, and 5 experimental fishing projects. The Hook Association has filed all the necessary reports, and those reports have indicated that the cod catch is no more than 5% of the haddock catch for the most part. They've indicated that the depths and bottom types in the expanded area are similar to those in the existing SAPs, so we shouldn't be concerned about the other areas that would be opened up. It's basically same depth and same bottom type. The Division of Marine Fisheries, by the way, has been asked to assist with some of the analyses of the experimental fishing data, and I should point out that those analyses are ongoing. As it stands right now, from our look at the data, the raw data, there seemed to be more than enough reason for us to move forward with this Hook Association request. The analyses that we will complete in the very near future indicate that months of access should be adjusted, then certainly the RA can do so. And then finally, I'll just repeat that the closed area SAP, the 6,275 metric tons, that's the approximately 14 million pounds TAC for this year, likely will not be caught. There'll be a tremendous shortfall. Therefore, without action, emergency action to extend the SAP in terms of time and in terms of area, there will just be a tremendous amount of lost yield. And I concluded that we should take action to prevent that loss of yield from occurring.
Anyone else? Dave Gatel.
Reluctantly, I have to take an opposing position. I've thought about this a lot. I've been uncomfortable with SAPs from day one because I think we need a broader discussion of closed areas in general and what it is we're trying to achieve with them. And I think we should have that discussion before we expand these SAPs or allow any more. I'm going to use an analogy because I don't want to offend anybody, and talking about cod and haddock gets people too riled up. So I'm going to say, let's for example, assume we have trout hatcheries here in New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, we raise trout and salmon in our hatcheries. But because we haven't harvested all the trout we could in the lakes and streams of New Hampshire, we decide we're going to let a certain group of fishermen into our hatchery to fish. And we're going to say, well, you can only use a certain kind of fly because that fly will only mostly catch trout. They'll catch a few salmon, but not that many. But the fact is that we're still allowing people into the hatchery to catch the broodstock of trout. And in the future, we're going to have less broodstock, so in the future, we're not going to have the fish we need to support the trout fishery throughout New Hampshire. So, you know, personally, I think that, and we're also going to catch some of the salmon, which we don't want to catch. So I think that we should have a much broader discussion about closed areas before we authorize, basically from the looks of this map, about two-thirds of this area being open to fishing. I think that we should either decide to rejigger the boundaries such that two things happen. One is that everybody gets more access to haddock. And second of all, that if we rejigger them at one end to allow more access for haddock, we close more bottom for cod, because we need to get more production out of cod. And I don't think the answer is to let people fish pretty much throughout the area, which negates the value. If you're going to do that, you ought to just open the area up altogether and say, everybody go catch haddock there. I just don't think this is the right way to proceed. We have a small area now. People are allowed to fish in. I reluctantly supported that. I will continue to support that because I think there are two competing interests here. The idea of using gear that is basically geared towards targeting one species versus this idea of protecting your brood stock and waiting for the fish to spill out of the closed area so that we can all benefit from them. But looking at SAPs in general here, I would not say they've been a big success, especially the yellowtail SAP. It was an absolute disaster. And now everybody in New England is paying for that one yellowtail SAP. And I'm not sure these haddock SAPs aren't going to end us up in the exact same position. That 5 or 6 years from now, because we've allowed people to go in here and fish for haddock, that we're not going to have the brood stock we need to continue to produce the year classes of haddock that are going to get us what we need. So all things considered, I have to say in all honesty, first of all, I don't see an emergency. There may be an economic emergency. Hell, my checkbook is always in an economic emergency. If anybody who owns a boat, it is. But, you know, as to the dogfish thing, hell, we're closed for 3 months. For the next 5 months, we're open. Dogfish are a fact of life. You know, you go out, you catch thousands of pounds of them, you throw them over. You know, our dogfish management plan is a failure, as far as I'm concerned. But that's not what we're here to debate today. You know, as long as we have the plan we have, people are going to have to fish through dogfish, and they better get used to it. They're going to just have to suffer, because there's going to be a hell of a lot of them out there, and you're just going to have to keep killing them to get at what you want. Again, I've read the letter very carefully. I've looked through all the bullet points that have been made, and I don't see an emergency for the resource, but I could see an emergency develop if we allow too much fishing in these closed areas. And I think that before we authorize any more incursions into closed areas, we ought to have the council ought to have a full debate on what it is we want out of our closed areas, why we're going to let people in them, and if we're going to let people in them at all, and what the size of them should be. And it appears to me that if people are saying the haddock never come out of these areas and the areas are too big, we ought to shrink the area and allow a percentage of the haddock to be caught, rather than saying to one particular group of people, okay, you can go fishing here, but everybody else, you've got to stay home. So, anyway, I'm going to oppose the measure.
Anyone else? Pat?
I have to be honest, I'm struggling with what the emergency is. But I did want to remind the council that I always vote no on emergency actions to preserve the Secretary of Commerce's discretion. And I have a question for the council, I guess. If this motion passes, is what you're asking, are you asking that the Fishery Service staff should stop working on Amendment 16, the midterm review and sectors, and work instead on an emergency action? That's my question to the council.
Anyone else? Anyone in the audience? Eric?
Eric Hess, fishing vessel Tenacious. I'm a hook fisherman. I fished in the SAP for several years. I just want to say it's been a very successful fishery with low bycatch. I also worked in the experimental fishery to develop it. It's been a real lifeline for hook fishermen, and this proposal opens this fishery really to everyone with no constraints. So it's being shown as a sort of a gift to one group of people, when in fact the first year it opened, lots of different boats came down and tried it. They were put off by the six-week season and the weather at that time of year, and I got the impression, and from talking to those fishermen, that they would definitely come back and invest the effort and change the gear over on their boats from whatever they currently use to hooks, and try to chase the haddock. I am a little confused about the growth rate thing. Assuming effective management of the haddock resource, those fish are still in the ocean, and maybe the tack will go down by 50%, but we're catching 5 or 10% of this tack that's allocated to it. That still leaves an awful lot of room for this opportunity for anyone to go in there with hooks and try to catch these haddocks. So I hope you'll support it, and I'm grateful to the state of Massachusetts for, looking at the data and offering their assistance to help analyze it.
John.
Yeah, John Auer, Misfits, Chatham. I sat here in the back of the room yesterday, and we talked about Corridor and Offshore Georges and how we need to access the TAC for Haddock, and I agreed with you. These boats are not going to make that big a dent in your TAC for Haddock. There's a couple large vessel autoliners that will come down from Gloucester, maybe 15, 20 small boats. That's it. You know, you proceeded very rapidly yesterday to talk about the Haddock Eliminator trawl, how successful it's going to work in this. And I was amazed how fast that could move. And then you have some opposition up front that I just don't agree with at all. So I'd like to really consider this. It gets a lot more boats off of cod. And I don't have an eliminator trawl, so I'm stuck with a hook. Thank you.
Anyone else? Dave?
Yeah, Dave Marciano, Fishing Vessel Hard Merchandise, Gloucester, Mass. This is a good opportunity for boats all around the spectrum. I urge you to move forward with this, please.
Anyone else? Stoop.
Stuart Tolley, Georges Bank, Fixed Gear Sector. Yeah, I'm mainly a gill netter, but I hook for Haddock during the fall. And I support the motion, or not the motion, but this fishery. And I want to say I think I fished this fall approximately 8 times. And I caught about 30 pounds of codfish. The bycatch is very little out there with the hooks. And I don't know, a lot of reasons that Dr. Pierce mentioned. This fishery is very extremely clean fishery. And I don't know, it gives an opportunity to a lot of vessels that are having tough times. And it gives them an opportunity to you know, maybe make some extra income that they wouldn't be making. And wish for your support. Thank you.
All right, back to the council. Rodney?
Yeah, I'm not against the concept, but I'm wrestling with the idea of an emergency. I mean, do we create emergencies for everybody to get into a closed area? That's what I'm wrestling with. If they can get in there and catch the Haddock without bothering the cod, I don't have a problem with it, but my problem is doing it under an emergency. I don't know if we can constitute that.
Anyone else? Sally?
Yeah. Just listening to the discussion, I think David Gaethel raised an important point, and this has been a tough one for me to consider, especially in light of the changes that we're likely going to be making moving from input to output-based management and the purpose of the closed areas and reconsidering what, in fact, their purpose is in light of a very different management scheme. So I just wanted to say that was an important point, I think, that we need to be considering, not just in the context of groundfish management or the habitat requirements that the council has to meet, but big picture, what is the purpose of various closed areas that we have layered on top of each other over the years? And for that reason, I'm going to abstain from this vote.
Mike?
I'm in favor of this motion. This is the only SAP that's actually been terminated because the time restraints have been full. Neither the TAC or the main TAC has been full. I do have a question, though. If this motion fails, does this die, or what happens to it then?
If this motion fails, then the council says it does not deem this to be an emergency, and so nothing happens.
Okay. Can we then make a motion to see if we can include this under 16?
I think we can have that discussion after after this vote. Anyone else? Dana Rice?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Although the question of the emergency and how it's done bothers me some, I think I would support this motion, and basically because of what feedback I've had from scientists, well-renowned scientists that have seen more than one explosion of haddock on Georges Bank over the years. Vaughn Anthony, for one, who's been telling me and a lot of other people that these fish need to be harvested. So I know it isn't the popular school of thought, and some of the things that you read from some haddock explosions are Goodyear classes of haddock in the North Sea. There is some science to back this. It's either say that we need to harvest this fish, and it's just sad that we sort of have to do it with an emergency action, but because of those sentiments and that advice from people, I'm going to support this motion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else in the council? Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. Is there any information that we have on, in changing the time, would it change the rate of cod interaction? I mean, it's easy to see how you might have one rate of interaction under the existing program, but if you change the seasonality of it, it may have a significantly different rate. Do we have information about that that we can look at?
I don't have the actual data in front of me, but who does?
Is there anybody that could answer that?
No.
I would point out that in the analysis that Andy Applegate did for the Norbait, and he pointed out to you that there are differences seasonally and aerially and spatially in the catch rates of cod. They were not specific. I mean, that comment was not specific to the closed area one hook your head except. The emergency action references studies that talk about different times and season, but I'm not sure I know which studies those are. I don't know if those are studies that were included in Andy's analysis or if there's something else that has been submitted. But we certainly don't have the data here right now, is I guess the bottom line.
I think the other point is that it's the SAP is bounded by a hard tack on codfish. So, but right. We don't have I don't have the specifics month by month. Jim Otham.
Yes, I am. I want to support this. I want to harvest more of the haddock, but I can't see this rising to the level of an emergency, and we haven't answered Pat's question. What are we going to have the service stop working on? So for those two reasons, I'm going to have to oppose the motion.
Okay. Anybody? Dave Preble?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a very tough one. As a general rule, I think that managing by emergency action is not managing at all. On the other hand, and that would lead me to very reluctantly not support this. On the other hand, we did that a year ago with the haddock issue. So I almost thought about abstaining, but I can't do that either. I think the fact that we used an emergency action a year ago is probably going to tip it just enough so that I'll probably support this, but it's just not the way to manage.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, John. Jim Laudlin precisely made my comments, so I agree with him.
Anyone else? John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. One of my concerns is the council might be, shoot itself in the foot. If it passes and we then feel that we dealt with this issue and it goes to the service, my strong feeling from the service is that they're going to say no. And therefore it becomes it's a dead issue. Mike has suggested that could it be incorporated into 16 That obviously doesn't provide that immediate relief that I'm sure the industry is looking for, but it probably keeps it alive as a remedy to a situation. And I just want to get your guidance. Would you still entertain a discussion of incorporating this into 16, even if it passes and goes to the service for their consideration?
I think that's a discussion for the council and a decision for the council to make. Roddy?
Yeah, Dave brought up a point. We used an emergency a year ago, but we use that emergency for everyone. This is just using an emergency for a select gear type. That's the difference. Thank you.
Dave?
Yeah, just as a point of order, I'd like a roll call on this one. You call the vote.
Roll call vote. Pat Kirkle?
I didn't get an answer to my question from any of the people that were supporting this. What is it that you expect us to stop doing to do this emergency action? Nobody addressed that question.
Dr. Pierce?
Well, obviously the regional administrator understands what staff resources are available within her office to deal with groundfish issues, and there are a lot of things to do, and I have to be sensitive to her specific concerns. I'll only echo what I said before, and that is, you know, my agency is involved now with an analysis of the data, which already indicates to us that there's justification for this action to be pursued. So we will be assisting the regional office in any way we can to move this forward, again, assuming the full council agrees that it should be moved forward at this time as an emergency.
Anyone else? Okay, roll call vote. Paul Howard?
Please read the motion and answer yes, no, or abstain. Rodney Avila?
No.
Frank Blount?
No.
Rip Cunningham?
No.
David Pierce?
Yes.
David Gaethel?
No.
Tom Hill?
Yes.
Mike Leary?
Yes.
Sally McGee?
Yes.
Pat Kirkle?
No.
Terry Stockwell?
No.
John Nelson?
No.
Jimmy Odlin?
No.
Dave Preble?
No.
Dana Rice?
Yes.
Tim Salisbury?
No.
David Simpson?
No.
And Mark Gibson?
No.
Motion fails.
Okay, Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are now going to go back to working on the draft amendment 16 summary of measures. That's document number one is what we will be working on today. I want to reiterate what I said yesterday and stress that our goal is to approve a set of alternatives to be included in Amendment 16 document for further development by the committee and by the PDT. We are not making the final decisions on these alternatives today. We are merely developing the document. I should also say that while you know, we have certain motions that the text that will be ultimately put into the document on this may be developed further than the wording that we're seeing here today. There are some issues that are already in here that are somewhat developed, but I just wanted to bring that to people's attention. We will be working through document number one almost on a section-by-section basis, and we will have individual motions to put forward with each of those sections. The So since we should jump right into it, we'll start out with the section 1.0, which is the updates on status determination criteria, rebuilding program mortality targets. I'm going to just keep going on this. This section essentially is a placeholder for when we get the information later in this year. And so we are simply at this point in time making a motion, which I will make on behalf of the committee, a motion to include a placeholder in Amendment 16, all for alternatives for revising status determination criteria, revising mortality targets for rebuilding programs, and if necessary, adopting additional formal rebuilding programs. Again, Tom.
Yeah. Just a brief explanation. This is something that Amendment 13 said we would do in 2009 for the most part. We're supposed to reevaluate this stuff and determine whether or not the status determination criteria need to be changed. Generally speaking, changes in numerical values are supposed to be automatic, but Amendment 13 said that would be done in the update. The piece that is supposed to be considered at any time and doesn't become effective is, for example, if you decide to use an index-based proxy rather than FMSY. But in this instance, it includes not only things like that, but it includes the numerical values would be put in this action as well.
Can we all bring the microphones closer?
Tom doesn't have a microphone. His vocal,
well, not just Tom, but I'm guilty as well, not getting close enough to the mic, and it's kind of hard to hear.
Oh, sorry.
Council? Jim?
Question of Tom, in that in the wording here, if I remember correctly, in Amendment 13, we were also going to check the viability of the biomass targets. And if we adopt this language, does that change the Amendment 13 objective to do a check or look at the biomass targets?
Well, give me a second to look up Amendment 13 for a minute. I think what Amendment 13 said, we would reevaluate the biomass targets, which is what is being done as part of the GARM process. And I know the GARM process is considering, in my opinion, maybe not in theirs, they do appear to be considering a broader range of issues than were considered during the original reference point working group meeting. Dr. Thompson referred yesterday, for example, to some of the ecosystem aspects that are being brought into the discussion, which were not included in the discussion in the past. So I think the answer to my question is yes, that those types of issues are being considered in this time around.
Anyone else on the council? Questions or comments? Pat?
This is not actually a committee motion, right? Where are you working from? I'm sorry.
I have a sheet of motions here. You're correct. This is not this one is not a committee was not a committee motion. So I guess that we'll take a step back and we would need a second for that. Seconded by Jim Odlin. Thank you, Matt. Anyone else on the council? On this one, since it is a placeholder, I'm not going to go to the audience on this. We ready for the vote? All those in favor? 13. 13 in favor. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. One abstention. Okay, we're going on to Section 2, the Fishery Administration Program. Under the first element for sector administration provisions, which is included as an attachment following page 17, because of the interest in sector development for this section, I'm not going to offer one motion, but will offer several motions that reflect the committee decisions. On page 19, under sector allocation process, this section has been updated to reflect a council action which was taken on January 24th. No motion at this time. Just wanted to bring that to people's attention. Sector definitions, formation of a sector on page 19. I do have a committee motion on this. The motion is to include as an amendment 16 alternative. Excuse me.
I think that motion got out of order. And
okay.
So let me just double check that. Yeah, that one's out of order. It actually comes up down the road.
Okay, so... just help me out there. We're on to the
this particular section formation
should be the next motion down to include as an amendment 16 alternative the sector formation.
Yes.
Okay. Have you got that one, Karen? Thank you. To include as an amendment 16 alternative the sector formation and operations plans requirements. As described in the Amendment 16 draft sector management measure document dated January 31, 2008. Tom, do you have some comments on that?
There's an issue I'm trying to trace down here. I'm not sure if it's in this section or in a later section. I think it's in a later section. I'll just mention it, but I believe it comes up at a later time. To point out that somewhere in here it says that the operations plan should be submitted by December 1st, which is a change from March 1st. And I'll just point out that that is not consistent at present with a recommendation from the service that it should be submitted September 1st. I mention it now, but I think it actually comes up in a later section that talks about, I'm trying to confirm that it comes up in a later section where we talk about what has to be in the operations plan and that type of thing. Oh, no, it's right there. I'm sorry. Page 21. Final operations plans may cover a two-year period and must be submitted to NIMS no later than December 1st. It is in this section. The language in here has attracted some attention, I don't know, from committee members, but from members of the public anyway. And this is in the box on page 21 that's highlighted in gray, the middle box. This is the same place that this December 1st date is mentioned. But earlier in that section, It talks about a preliminary operations plan to the council no less than 1 year prior to the date, and then a final operations plan to NIMS no less than December 1st. This is a slight change, pretty much a staff change, to be honest with you, from what's in Amendment 13. Amendment 13 says you have to submit an operations plan to the to NIMS through the council by a year before. And what has actually happened with at least the fixed fare sector is they did meet that deadline. They submitted an operations plan. But over time and through discussions and interaction with the council, they made some modifications to that operations plan before it was finally submitted as a formal plan to NIMS. All this language is trying to make clear is that to acknowledge the fact that, you know, these people submit an ops plan to the council. There is some give and take between the council and the sector, between NIMS and the sector, and there may be ultimately changes to the operations plan before they submit a final one to NIMS at whatever date the council agrees on. That's all we're trying to do here. It has drawn some questioning from members trying to submit sectors about, well, you know, what does this mean, a preliminary ops plan and a final plan? But that's all we're trying to recognize, that when they first submit it to the council, these tend to be a little bit of a work in progress because there may be things the council doesn't like, maybe suggestions that are made initially that come up.
Tom, I just wanted to bring up this point, too. I don't know if it confuses it or clarify it. The committee did discuss the September 1 deadline, which was requested by the service. For whatever reason, the committee that I recall any strong objection to that, but for whatever reason, we never actually took any action on that. So whether that's, you know, a correction we can make at this point in time.
Dave Gaethel?
Yeah, I have a question. First of all, what is a preliminary operations plan? Is that and then I have some more questions for Pat that may probably follow up on that.
I think a preliminary operations plan is your plan for how you're going to harvest the resource that your sector is allocated. I think the reason the word preliminary is in there is because it's your first introduction to the council. This is what our plan is. The council may then not like something or make suggestions to modify something, so that's why the word preliminary is there.
Okay, that clarifies that. How does that relate to this March 1st letter that we received? In other words, basically, what is due on all the dates that are in that March 1st the dear permit holder letter? What is due from the sector managers on those dates? Is that in relation to this preliminary operations plan, or is it something else?
I have to ask the service to Mark Grant here, or Pat Kirkel wants to talk about the notice to permit holders. George? Mark?
Nobody did Mark in those two.
I'm just going to take a second and pull up a copy of the letter.
While he's doing that, I wonder if the chairman could, I don't have in front of me how many motions there are, and just to get a feel for, you know, just how many motions there are so the council can gauge the debate on these type of motions or if there are any meaty motions.
All right. Basically, what we're looking for at this stage of the game is simply the complete, well, the maximum roster for each sector. So what we want to know is all the vessels that are planning on joining each particular sector by March 1 if they're looking for their information to be detailed, or May 1 if they're looking to only have their allocations computed in aggregate. And we still acknowledge that vessels have up to June 1st to decide to withdraw from the sector, but we don't want to have anyone additional added to the sector after the March 1 and May 1 dates. The basic reasoning is that we're going to need, based on the number of sectors and the number of vessels we anticipate participating, we're going to need a full year to do all of the computations necessary to get TAC allocations, and, well, really less than a year, because we're going to have to put out proposed rules and final rules long before the May 1 start date, and we're going to need to put together all the information by vessel, by sector, compute their proposed allocations based on whatever the target TACs are going to be, and put that out to public comment.
Dave?
Kate, if I might, just to follow up, so that doesn't include the preliminary operations plan, and that you need a list of vessels and permit numbers that are going to be in each sector by either March 1st or May 1st, depending on which allocation option they choose. Is that correct? Okay, I'm trying to answer these because we have to answer these for the audience today as somehow as part of our discussion as we go along, so that people can make this decision.
Pat Kirkle.
Just to add to that, actually for this year, people have already submitted their preliminary operations plans. So what we were talking about is, now that we've got these preliminary operations plans, we know what the universe is. This is what we need in terms of the list, the roster.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mark?
A clarification, and I'll be sending out another permit holder letter this coming week, hopefully clarifying some of the details. For these rosters, what we're looking for is a simple signed statement from each permit holder stating, this is the sector I'm considering joining, and, you know, that can also acknowledge that they have the right to withdraw up until June 1. But just so that we don't have, you know, a long list of vessels that say any one of these may join any one of X sectors, we need each prospective sector member to state affirmatively, my intent is to join Sector A or Sector B.
So a vessel owner, permit owner couldn't send you two letters saying, I want to join Sector A and Sector D, considering it?
Actually, we were, I think, anticipating that they would select which particular sector at this point, not more than one, because in order for us to do the calculations, we need to start working on them in detail now.
Okay. Rip, Paul Howard had a question. How many motions do we have today?
I have in total 16.
Would it be possible to get a printout of those motions so that the council members have them in front of them? Is that something we could do if we were to take a break?
Sure, that's possible.
If we were to take a break after this motion or these motions?
Yeah, we just have to copy it.
Is that something we could do, Karen? Okay. Dr. Pierce, then Mike Leary.
All right, regarding the... If you can't hear me, let me know. Regarding the operations plan, I've got a question for the chair and for staff, and that is, the document as it stands right now, is there any part of this document relative to the operations plan that addresses one of the key elements of the council's policy with regard to sectors, and that is effort displacement? We're very specific in our sector policy about our concern about effort displacement, that is, vessels moving from ground fish onto other fisheries once they get into sectors. Page 1 of our sector policy has that reference, and then page 2 as well, where it indicates that in terms of mortality controls in fisheries not directly impacted by the sector fishery. Each FMP sector program should require that sector applicants identify potential redirection of effort as a result of sector operations and propose limitations, if necessary, to eliminate any adverse effects of effort direction, redirection. That's a critical aspect of sector management that I don't believe this council has addressed satisfactorily as yet, on, let's say, the committee. But I need to be corrected. If I'm wrong, please tell me. Is there anything within this document that is specific to that concern, that policy of the council?
Tom?
I don't believe there's anything in the operations plan that talks about it. There is a change or a clarification in the reporting section that makes it clear that sectors in their annual reports are supposed to report catches of all species. The sectors are currently only reporting catches of species on groundfish days at sea. The regulations say they're supposed to report all managed species. The intent of making that clarification is so that it's possible to tell that there is redirection of effort going on. But I don't believe that the ops plan section includes anything such as you were suggesting, David.
I would suggest that we put something into the operations plan requirements that would be that would pertain to that particular concern that I've just addressed. So I would make a motion to there's a motion on the floor, right? Could that be put back up on the screen?
I think they're using the. There you go.
All right, then I would amend the motion to add that the sector's operations plan must include a list of all federal and state permits held by vessels that would be part of the sector. And a description of the extent to which effort displacement to other state and federal waters fisheries will occur. And that way we'll know up front, to the extent that we can possibly know up front, what we might anticipate regarding a redirection of effort onto other fisheries.
Is there a second? Seconded by John Nelson. Tom Neese?
Yeah, I would point out that while it's not specifically listed here, that when we do our NEPA documents, we're required to describe the impacts of our actions on other fisheries. So, you know, whether this is an explicit requirement or not, I mean, this would fit in very well with that requirement that we're usually held to, and presumably the sector EAs should address the same concern.
Paul Howard.
I think as we, you know, go down this, especially as we're going to go down this road with ACLs and AMs and other fisheries, we have to be careful about what we're trying to do within a specific species plan. And I've mentioned this before. I believe the council needs a long discussion about which plan should restrict other plans. And I think a groundfish plan should worry about groundfish primarily, and that if there's effort into a different species, that species plan should have the controls and ACLs and AMs to control its species, whether it's a Mid-Atlantic plan or our plan. And I think that's something that you ought to debate at length. Do you really want to control in the groundfish plan effort in another fishery in terms of ACLs and AMs, which is what we're talking about? And I think we need that debate down the line.
Terry Stockwell and Dave Gaethel and John Nelson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. question to David through you. In trying to tease this apart, you're going to be requesting the sector manager to project what the separate vessels in the sector are going to be fishing on?
Well, if I may, the sector manager has a tough job, no matter how you look at it. In light of what we haven't yet decided regarding sector management, who will be in each individual sector, I suspect that most sectors don't know that yet, as they struggle to find out who would be involved, who would be interested in joining this sector. They're going to have to know eventually who will be in the sector. They'll have a list of vessels. I think we should know what permits they have for each individual fishery. Therefore, we'll have a better idea as to the potential shift of effort between fisheries. They're not going to know for sure. We're not going to know for sure, but I would like a little bit more insight into what might happen. And I would like to put the burden on the sector to provide us up front in their operations plan what they expect might happen with regard to how they will use those permits. For example, will they take whatever allocation they get for groundfish and put it on a handful of vessels in the sector, and then the other vessels will redirect their effort onto other fisheries in which they're already involved, but perhaps more so than ever before because now their history is on another vessel. They won't be fishing for groundfish. They'll be fishing on squid, on fluke, in some state's waters fisheries for which they might have a permit. This is something we need to know up front as best we can get that information in order for us to, again, be sincere about the sector policy that we have adopted and have already, you know, read those specific issues that relate to a redirection of effort that has been clearly stated by this council as a major concern because it's folded into our policy and mentioned twice.
Yeah, reluctantly, I'm going to oppose this because I think I understand where David's going, and I think he does need the information, but I agree with what Paul said, that you know, groundfish manages groundfish. It doesn't manage whiting. It doesn't manage dogfish. It doesn't manage monkfish. It doesn't manage, you know, on and on and on. I mean, we're going to bury these sectors under a blizzard of paperwork that they'll never get out from under. They'll never even be able to get off the ground. I mean, I could already see you're going to have 20 secretaries just to comply with the paperwork requirements. And quite frankly, NIMS is going to disappear. Blackburn Drive will just be this big mound of white. You won't even be able to find a building with the amount of stuff you're going to have to submit. This is absurd. I mean, I think, you know, if you want to, you know, have them report their groundfish landings, that's one thing. But you want to get their whiting, their dogfish, their lobsters, their monkfish, their bluefish, their on and on and on, all the way down into the mid-Atlantic with probably 25 more species down there, that's an unreasonable request, I believe. I think the idea is to get these things up and running and let's see what happens. And if we see a problem, then let's deal with it. But, it's like looking through this glass of water at David. I know he's over there, but I really can't see him very well. And you know, that's what we're asking people to do right now. We're asking them to get out the crystal ball, look through the glass of water, and tell us what's going to happen in a couple of years. And I think that's unreasonable.
John Nelson.
That's always Dave is always a tough act to follow. I don't have the analogies that he can use. I like the trout one earlier, David. Yes, you can. Listen up. Mr. Chairman, and this probably does show that I've been around too long, I thought we had in our policy that the stated that the sector operations plan needed to reference what impact or displacement of effort would take place because of their operations. I thought we had that in there, and I certainly could be corrected. I know we discussed having that in there, and we didn't go into great depth, I don't think, as far as how they had to describe it, but we said that the appropriate FMP committee needed to take into consideration displacement of effort. Now, recognizing it, are you going deaf? Good Lord. Give him Pat's mic, and that way we won't have to have any other problems. Sorry, Dave. Anyways, Mr. Chairman, I thought we had dealt with that issue. at least as an overview, the details of fleshing it out certainly we could continue to do. But am I mistaken? I thought that was in the policy already.
I believe that this motion will make it more explicit.
Yeah, and I don't object to this motion. I just wanted to make clear to the maker of the motion, since the seconder already knew, that this is just a reaffirmation of what has already been adopted in the policy.
Okay.
I think that this amendment makes things a little, like I said, a little more explicit, and from the perspective of trying to capture activity outside of the groundfish plan, this concern over displacement in other fisheries, it certainly sets a mechanism up that allows that tracking to occur, and it's clear. You know, you have to provide all the other permits, state and federal, and at the end of the year, you have to provide landings in those fisheries in your annual report. Right now, it's a gray area. I mean, the way it's written, I've argued that, number one, we weren't told we had to record that information outside of the groundfish plan, and number two, we haven't been collecting the data, so I can't report it to you. So, and that's the way it currently is being prosecuted. I had Frank Blount, then Rodney. Rodney.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with this till David wants me to produce my marriage licenses. Then I will have a problem with it.
Which one? Sally?
I would have offered to second this motion if it had been limited to just the list of permits held by vessels that are opting into the sector. But to ask people to guess what the effort displacement may be as the operations plan is submitted, I think is unreasonable and not going to give us information that's going to be helpful in determining what the nature of the fishery is going to be or what the nature of the impact of the sector is going to be. So for that reason, I'm going to oppose the motion, but would ask if there could be consideration of dropping the second part of it that requires the description of the extent to which effort is may be displaced.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Dave Gaethel's comments. And further, it seems to me that we're requesting a whole lot of information, and essentially we don't have any program or anything that we're going to use that information for. And it seems to me like, you know, it's just another pile of information that we're going to collect that sits in a shoebox somewhere and collects dust. So I would oppose this unless it got changed the way that Sally indicated.
Pat Kirkle.
That hurt. I'm going to support the motion. As Tom Neese pointed out, this is something that is part of our sort of general NEPA requirements. To provide some sort of information with respect to the impacts of this displaced effort. And I don't, frankly, think it's unreasonable for a sector manager to know what the boats in the sector intend to do outside of the groundfish activity. I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation.
Anyone else before I call the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Seven opposed. Ten. Motion fails, 7-10. Dr. Pierce.
I'd like to make another motion. Essentially, it's the same motion that's on the screen, except to remove the last part and a description of the extent to which. So it would end with a list of federal and state permits held by vessels that would be part of the sector.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Any further discussion on this issue? Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is actually worse because what I had thought is, you know, you can provide a list of vessels pretty simply and what their permits are. And then you can do a narrative because you know in your sector what people are likely to do and you can make suggestions about it. This leaves it wide open for interpretation that, well, look, we've got all these permits that have, these boats that have squid permits. Oh, they're going to ruin the squid fishery. But they may not have any intention of even involving themselves in the squid fishery. So you're kind of leaving an open-ended implication there. And I think the other one was far preferable because you just say, well, we're, you know, seven of the boats are going to tie up and one of them is going to go into squid fishery. And, you know, you have a sense of what it is. This, I think, just is asking for misinterpretation. Thank you.
Anyone else? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed?
It's five.
The motion to amend carries 12 to 5. We're now on the main motion. Anything further on this issue? Ready for the question? Pat Kirkle.
Just a clarification. I where this issue of the changing the date ended up, the December, was that a committee consensus that just didn't get changed in the document, or do we need a motion?
Well, it's not in this motion, and it's part of the document and part of the discussion.
It's part of the main motion.
It was changing to September 1st. It's described in Amendment 16, Sector Management.
Right. Okay. Tom, can you clarify?
Yeah, I think if you want to change the submission date to September 1st, it would be clearest to either incorporate it into this motion or another motion. The committee does have on record a motion that says they want it December 1st. They held a discussion about NMSA's recommendation to make it September 1st, but the discussion, frankly, was inconclusive. No one objected to the September 1st date. Some committee members said, sure, if NMSA wants to change the date, let them change the date. But nobody ever made a motion, so I think it would be clearest if there were a motion, if that's what the council wants to do.
Okay, so Pat makes a motion to amend to change the dates. Is there a second? Jim Odlin? From December 1st to September 1st for submission. Discussion? Okay, it seems pretty basic. I'll go to the audience. Maggie?
Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I'm a little bit confused about the, I think there might be some mixing up of terminology. The current regulations, I believe, say you need to submit a proposal and a draft EA, and an operations plan is different. So does this now mean you have to submit a proposal, a draft EA, and an operations plan 1 year in advance? Or are you saying operations plan and not the EA?
I don't know what a proposal is. I know what an EA is, and I know what an operations plan is. But I'm not sure what the term proposal means. Just speaking as somebody that's been submitting documents for 4 or 5 years.
Well, I believe the regulations actually use the word proposal now. And when we submitted a proposal for the 2008 fishing year for a sector, it was basically a letter that described, you know, who we were. And then we had a draft environmental assessment. But we didn't actually lay out how the sector in an operations plan was going to operate.
Tom Neese, then Pat Kirk.
I'll read what Amendment 13 says. A sector will submit its in one spot. It says a sector will submit its operation plan to the council no less than 1 year prior to the date it begins operations. That is what the fixed gear sector did. They also accompanied that with an appropriate NEPA document, because in another spot, Amendment 13 says an appropriate NEPA document assessing the impacts must be prepared, written by the sector applicant, submitted to NIMS through the council. The regulations don't really spell that out in a clear order. They have a section that says you will submit a proposal 1 year in advance, and then the next paragraph of the reg says you will submit, you know, any sector approved under the previous section will submit the following documents, and that's where it talks about ops plans. So it definitely needs to be cleared up about what exactly needs to be submitted when. Now, you know, either spelled out more clearly in the amendment or spelled out more clearly in the regs, one or the other. It was very useful that the fixed gear sector submitted the operations plan, because there were some ways where they initially planned to operate that some council members weren't comfortable with. And there was a discussion back and forth with them. And they changed, I don't remember the specifics, but they actually modified some of their plans on how they were planning to operate.
Could I follow up?
Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, just to follow up quickly. And so I had understood that this language that Tom was proposing in here, where it speaks to the preliminary operations plan and the final operations plan, the preliminary operations plan is what would be submitted first in May, is it? March.
March or April.
Okay. And then the final operations plan and the EA are what we're proposing should be submitted by September 1st.
Maggie.
Okay. To the motion to amend, we don't have any objection to moving that to September 1st. But while I have the mic, there was a question that was raised earlier about the letter from the service regarding these new deadlines for the sectors that are proposed for 2009. And I'm hoping at some point that we're going to have some more discussion about that letter and the impracticability of some of those deadlines. Thank you.
Jackie.
Who seconded this motion?
Jim Odlin.
Jackie O'Dell, North ECFA Coalition. Similar to what Maggie just said, we're hoping that we're going to have a more completed discussion on what the letter went out to the permit holders and what is actually required of people now who have submitted sectors to be operational for 2009, because here we're talking about draft Amendment 16 policy that has not been approved yet, has not been codified. We're operating under Amendment 13 policy, and there's this serious confusion by sector proponents of what do we do in the meantime. We have letters that are being sent out. We have new deadlines that are coming up, but, you know, we're operating under Amendment 13 law. We have sector rosters that have not been defined that, you know, are now being said that we have to submit when we've been submitting catch history forms for people who are going to join our sector. So there's, you know, this in-between period for a lot of us is very confusing. You know, Pat had mentioned before that she's already received a few operations plans. I'm assuming those are already for the sectors that have already been approved, that, you know, have been submitted for fishing in this coming fishing year. So, you know, again, there's this serious confusion of what do I need to do as a new sector proponent? I'm looking at the Amendment 13 law. You know, we're discussing here draft Amendment 16 law, which is, you know, what's going to be implemented in a year or two from now. So, you know, I'm hoping we're going to have a better discussion about this later. And I don't have a problem either with the September 1st date. But, again, Does that mean for this year, or does that mean for after Amendment 13 gets implemented? Hey, 16, excuse me. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Yeah, we will. We'll have a discussion about that. It's still fuzzy in my mind as well. So, back to the motion on the board. Anything further? The motion to amend. All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. So now we're back on the main motion as amended. Anything further? There it is. Anything further on the main motion as amended? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Unanimous. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break. If you look in front of your seat, you should have a copy of the amendment. It says Amendment 16, Alternatives Discussion. Thank Karen and Tom and staff for putting that together for us. Hopefully that'll help focus and guide people. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motions and that were handed out to you, we are on page number 2 of that, and we are at the section titled Movement Between Sectors. That's found on page 21 of that document 1. So those would be the two things to be looking at. Essentially, the movement between sectors, we have no motion to offer at this time. That is the same wording that was in Amendment 13. I'm trying to figure out how to go through these just in my head. We'll put up on the board the motion, and this is a committee motion to include as in Amendment 16 as an Amendment 16 alternative that sectors will receive a hard tack of all regulated ground fish with the exception of ocean pout, windowpane flounder, and Atlantic halibut, and that there will not be a cap on the share of a stock that can be allocated to a sector.
The committee motion does not require a second discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, this one has been especially difficult for me because I, for quite a long time, have supported the concept of a cap, a maximum amount that could be taken by a sector. We discussed this, of course, at the committee level extensively, and this council also has discussed it. And there are quite a lot of pros and cons. And I know there are pros and cons because the plan development team apparently was divided on this issue. And that's what I would like to focus on right now as part of this motion. That's to get a little bit better clarification from the plan development team, that is through Tom, regarding why, for example, there was support from at least some members of the plan development team that we should actually support the cap, if not on one stock, perhaps on the fishery as a whole. That is a summary of the plan development team, a brief summary of the plan development team discussion shown in document number 4 on page 13, where you'll see the committee motion to eliminate the cap on allocation of sector shares. I didn't prevail in my opinion regarding keeping the cap. Again, I'd appreciate, and I think the council should hear, once again, a brief synopsis describing the plan development team's position on the cap. That might help us in our discussion on this motion.
Tom, are you prepared to
answer that? Give me just a second. I want to find the PDT report that's applicable just to make sure I accurately represent the PDT's discussion.
Okay, while we wait, anyone on the council wish to comment? Dave Gaethel?
A question, Mr. Chair. Because I'm starting to get a little confused. Is the formation of the sectors that's going on right now, they're still being formed under Amendment 13. Is that correct?
Yep.
So they still have a 20% cap?
Yes.
So this is for either formation of sectors in the future or for consolidation of sectors formed under Amendment 13 when Amendment 16 goes into effect. Is that correct?
Tom Neese?
Yeah, I think you got to be careful here. The sectors that are implemented with Amendment 16 are going to have to meet Amendment 16 rules as of the day the amendment's implemented. It was clearly the intent of the committee that removing the cap in Amendment 16 meant that if these 19 sectors get approved, that they won't have a cap on ACE.
That is exactly my question. That's so we people forming sectors today will have to meet the Amendment 16 regulations, even though the Amendment 16 regulations won't go into effect until the day their sector will start to operate, potentially.
That's correct. That's what happened in Amendment 13 as well.
Okay. I just wanted to be very clear then. So we are talking about removing the 20% cap on sectors of a given stock from now on.
Upon implementation of 16, if this passes, yes.
If this passes. All right. Now I'm perfectly clear. I want to make sure everybody else is clear on this because this is a very, very important point, at least to me.
Tom, did you have the PDT document you were looking for, or should I take another comment?
You can take another comment, but I do have the document.
Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. The committee asked the PDT for advice on this issue of caps, and what the PDT did is we went back and looked at a draft NOAA technical memorandum prepared by Lee Anderson and Mark Holliday that talks about the design and use of limited access privilege programs. That document talked a little bit about the concept of excessive shares in these limited access privilege programs, so even though a sector may not be a LAP, we felt that the technical advice was still applicable. Anderson and Holliday note that there's generally two broad reasons to consider limiting shares. You might want to prevent excessive market power, or you might want to achieve management objectives. Now, they provide an analytic framework in order to how to calculate whether or not a share will result in excessive market power. We didn't actually apply this framework and do any calculations, but we are extremely skeptical, and the Holliday and Anderson report is skeptical as well, that any one species or stock is going to be enough to grant someone excessive market power. There's just too many substitutes for groundfish in the market, both U.S. and imports. The demand can be pretty elastic, so that we don't think there's any possibility, really, that an individual stock share could be sufficient for someone to exercise market power. Now, it might be possible, and we haven't done this calculation, that market power for the fishery as a whole could be a concern if someone possessed a large share of all the available groundfish resources. So we suggested to the committee that they consider whether they think a cap should apply to a total stock basis. In other words, you might be able to get 90% of the Cape Cod yellowtail flounder as a share of ACE, but you wouldn't be able to get 90% of everything as your share of ACE. That's the point we were making. Now, the other point that Anderson and Holliday talk about is that it's possible that you may have management objectives that suggest that a lower share limit is appropriate meaning a lower limit than the share necessary to develop market power. You know, and if you identify or were to identify legitimate management objectives for limiting sector shares, you might want to consider something that is designed to do management objectives, to achieve a management objective. Let me give you an example. Amendment 13 has an objective that says, to the extent possible, maintain a diverse groundfish fishery, including different gear types, vessel sizes, geographic locations, and levels of participation. Well, if you don't have a limit, it's at least theoretically possible that, you know, one sector with one, fishing out of one port with one type of gear may be able to acquire enough to control the groundfish fishery and avoid that management objective. But the PDT pointed out you got to be careful here because it's also entirely possible that a sector with a large share might actually foster achieving that objective because the sector may consist of a diverse group of gears fishing out of a diverse group of ports. So you need to be careful about what objective it is you're trying to achieve if you decide to put a cap on to achieve specific management objectives. The committee talked about these two issues. They did not feel that the market power was a concern, and they felt that the industry was diverse and unlikely that a share would develop which would conflict with the management objectives that have been adopted.
Paul Howard.
I think when we talk about shares, we should also be talking about permits. And in the scallop fishery, they did limit the amount of permits an owner could have. I think it's 10%. We haven't done that with groundfish. So if you just look at sector quota, a owner could own 100 permits and create, if it's 20%, could pick up five sectors or something like that. So the real issue that you might want to get to, which we never have, is capping the permits that an owner can own at 10% like we did with scallops. And I think that might, you know, if there are some 1,400 permits now, at least that's, 10%. But I don't think we've ever done that anywhere. So if you just do sector quota, that doesn't prohibit someone from owning a couple sectors and still having the, you know, number of permits. So I think of capping the permits first.
Jim Odlin, then Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I've supported removing the cap, and the reason is that I think you're just creating a shell game if you don't. I mean, if a sector looks at their, before they submit, they look at what they've got, and they say, oh, my goodness, we're up to 30% of it, one item. They'll say, okay, well, we got to split the sector. They split the sector in half, use the same manager, and trade ace. What have you done? You haven't accomplished anything. Sector allocations are good for 1 year. As far as number of permits, it would be different in groundfish because 10% of the permits would be a big, huge number. But in scallops, every permit was equal. In groundfish, if you're looking at allocation, the number of permits really doesn't mean much. It's the total allocation. So I think you're really worried about something that probably won't happen. And if it did, if you don't have that there, then you have to look at, are we going to limit trading of ace to a certain level? And then I think you start to undermine what you're trying to accomplish with the sectors, is allow utilization of the resource. So if you leave the cap in place, then you have to look at what you're going to do when you start trading ace. Otherwise, people can just have two sectors. It can be the same manager, same paperwork, same everything. I mean, you've just created nothing. So that's why I support this.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be able to forecast what's going to happen in the future relative to sector management, how it works, how it doesn't work, but it certainly is very unfamiliar territory, and there are pitfalls, those pitfalls related to the Amendment 13 objectives that were just summarized about maintaining a diverse fishery. But I'm concerned about the unexpected, unanticipated impact on coastal communities, on shoreside structure, shoreside support, impact geographically. I suppose this will all be analyzed somehow in the documents we eventually have to produce for this amendment, but as it stands right now, I'm still concerned about excessive shares, excessive market power. Sure, the plan development team doesn't think that will happen. Well, I don't know to what extent that's true, that it won't happen. I'm uncomfortable with just removing the cap entirely. I would like to have actually a separate vote on the cap. The way the motion is worded right now, I suspect most, if not all, council members would vote for it in light of the first part of the motion. Therefore, I would move to split the question because they are completely unrelated, the two issues that are discussed, so that the first motion would read up to Atlantic Halibut, then there would be a period there, and then the second motion would be that there be a cap on the share of a stock that can be, the words are already up there.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaethel. Discussion? We have to vote on whether we split it or not. All those in favor of splitting the question? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 in favor. Opposed? 9 opposed. The motion to split fails. Back on the motion. Dave Gaethel.
I make a motion to amend to reinstate the 20% cap. Where it says no cap, change that to 20%.
I guess that's one way to do it. The other way would be to just strike the removal of the cap. I mean, we have a cap in place now.
Right. The cap now is 20%, right?
Right.
So all I'm stating is I want to keep the same 20%. I'm putting a specific number in on purpose.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, I might, if you allow me some liberty, I might remind the council that what we're trying to do here is prepare alternatives for the document, not make final decisions. The document, of course, will include the no-action alternative. The council, depending what you do with this particular motion, what this motion does is it removes the, if this passes, it removes the option to consider removing the cap. You always have the option at the final vote to say you're rejecting this alternative which removes the cap.
We're going to need a second, but thank you, Tom. Is there a second? Dr. Pierce? Discussion on the motion to amend?
I'm sorry. I think you need a cap. I agree with what Jimmy said. It could end up being a shell game. That's what Scallops is right now. You change you change one corporate officer. You know, put one kid in there or something. A different kid in each corporation, and it's a different corporation. But I don't want to see our fishing communities consolidated in a heartbeat like what I saw in New Zealand. It broke my heart to go over there and see little towns with nobody left fishing in them because they just said, we don't have fishing communities. We have communities with fishermen in them. And, you know, we just happened to get rid of all those fishermen. It's not right. That's why I've been fundamentally on the fence about this whole LAPP thing from day one. I really believe no matter what we put in for caps, they're going to get broken at some time in the future anyway. I don't think the political will is there to keep from having the corporatization of the fisheries once we start down this road, but at least it won't be on my watch.
Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to reiterate what Tom said. By leaving in the alternative for no cap, it gives us one additional alternative, and it if we eliminate it, we eliminate the opportunity to put it in there. So I would not support this.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not support the motion to amend. I do support the option of having an alternative, and the 20% to me is quite arbitrary.
Mike Leary.
I oppose the motion also. This is took considerable amount of time at the committee level, and if you're trading – Ace anyway, what's the cap? It doesn't do anything, so I oppose the motion.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience, Maggie.
Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. As a matter of practicability, there are 19 sector applications and only 19 for 2009. There are four separate allocation alternatives under consideration. It's going to be a while before anybody knows what percentage of anything that they would get, ultimately, depending on what the council picks. So what do you do if you are over then? What do you do with that? That sector doesn't get approved? They have to kick people out? How exactly are you supposed to deal with that? I would suggest that if there's a concern about how someone taking control of the fishery, some big boogeyman taking control of the fishery, that you limit the term for which a sector can be implemented. So right now, I believe you're going to come to a recommendation that sectors can submit operations plans for multiple years. So you might want to limit that to some, 3 years or something, and then you can always pull the plug if something went crazy. And when the sector comes back to renew their plan in the fourth year, for example, you could say, no, you have too much share, you have to split up.
Vito?
Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. We're all for flexibility, and we don't want to have arbitrary numbers actually restrict sector formation. But at the same time, the council in Amendment 13 has the ability to authorize something greater than 20%. One of the concerns of keeping this motion together is I don't know how much of an option it really is unless there's the split motion made sense because, allocating hard tax on all stocks to sectors is probably something that should be kept separate from this very important issue of caps. We'd like to see some options in there. One of the difficult things of protecting fishing communities is going to be to leave that blank check wide open. We think the ACE and permanent shares are two different things altogether. I think, the ability to move ACE around is advantageous, and there should not be a cap on that. But caps on ownerships aren't necessarily something that we would favor being thrown out altogether. We would not want to see a sector under the 19 sectors that we have right now, have a sector not be able to move forward as a result of having 26% of a stock or something like that. I think we should really think about that, separate the motion. I know that got turned down. Do the hard tack on all stocks and give yourself a few options in this. Give the council the ability to say, sector A is coming forward. They've got 27% on this stock, 22% on that, and say, okay, that's fine. Have an option in there that absolutely accepts that. But, having a cap at some point is going to possibly be something, as David Pierce said, something that's going to be very critical in protecting fishing communities. Otherwise, you make it very easy to leverage the system and try to have, the strongest sector suck up all the quota. That can happen. And I think it might make sense to have some options in there specific to caps.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Anything further? John Nelson?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. On flexibility, as you pointed out, or someone has pointed out, you have something in there already for the no action that therefore has a 20% cap in place. If this fails and the main motion, you therefore have no cap. Now, does that give the flexibility of the council to, after public comment, et cetera, to pick anywhere between no and 20%?
I would think so, yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure that it is clear that that's the intent. if we wind up with a no cap and a 20%, you can pick something in between at the final long day of decisions.
Those would be the bounds of the alternatives we would have in the document under your hypothesis. Anything further on the motion to amend? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Two. Opposed? Fourteen opposed. The motion to amend fails. We're back on the main motion. Anything further on the main motion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Sixteen opposed. One. Motion carries 16-1.
We're on to page 22, the U.S.-Canada area. As indicated on the sheet, the section's been updated to reflect committee decisions. And on behalf of the committee, I would offer a motion to include as an Amendment 16 alternative that sectors will receive specific allocation for those stocks that have a TAC specific to the eastern U.S.-Canada area. And I think, Tom, do you have a couple of comments to add to that? Or?
No, I don't think so. David?
Question for, I'm not sure who, but is this irrelevant if we pick a straight history only allocation scheme and people have no history of Eastern Canadian, of the Eastern area?
Tom?
No, it's not irrelevant. It applies regardless of which alternative. Excuse me. It applies regardless of which alternative you pick for allocating to the sectors. There are no. I'll leave it.
Jim Adler.
Just for explanation, what this means is that if you receive 1% of the Georges Bank card, you will receive 1% of the Georges Bank, the Eastern Georges Bank quota, because that's a subset of the Georges Bank card. Same thing on Haddock.
David?
Well, my question is, what if you receive 0%? Is now you going to receive something else?
If you get 0% of Georges card, you get 0% of the Eastern Georges Bank card.
Okay. All right. I that isn't the way I read it, so. Okay.
Anyone else on the council? Pat Kirkle.
I'm opposed to the motion. This doesn't address the issue of SAPs. And looking just at SAPs and the U.S.-Canada area, if you give an allocation to all the sectors that have proposed operation plans or that have proposed to become sectors for either 2009 or 2010, then you're talking about somewhere around 500 different quotas. And I don't see how the council is going to justify that administrative burden, frankly.
Anyone else in the council? Frank Baum.
Yeah, I supported this. Are you here with Pat today? I supported this in the committee, but I'm also thinking back to a discussion we had yesterday, and just for lack of a better term, I'll still call it the Kendall Highway. If we're going to redo the closed areas, and if that's an option, and one of those is the Kendall Highway, there's going to be people that haven't had access to an area in 20 years. And now we're saying we're going to not give you, because you haven't had access, you're not going to have any access to the new opened area. So for that reason, I'm going to oppose it.
Council? John Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if this motion does not pass, what does that mean for anybody? I'm not clear as far as what's the alternative that's out there at this particular point.
Tom Neese.
If this motion does not pass, then people get allocations as they do now for Georges Bank Cod, Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder, and Georges Bank Haddock, and they're not specific to the eastern U.S. Canada area. They can catch their allocation anywhere. But the fallout of that is that what that means is that if you're a sector, and you may be a sector that plans for is expecting a large amount of Georges Bank Haddock or whatever, and you're expecting that you're going to go into the eastern U.S. Canada area to catch it, and you may not be able to catch it because the common pool vessels or perhaps other sector vessels go out and catch the limited cod tack before you have a chance to get your haddock. So the potential is that this basically creates a situation where you've got a race to fish out in the eastern U.S. Canada area for those resources because the catch is limited by, generally tends to be limited by cod. One of the reasons that we say in Amendment 13 for the formation of sectors is that it helps you avoid, it mitigates the effects of the effort controls, it allows for more efficient use of your harvesting power. If you don't take care of that in the eastern U.S. Canada area, well, then what happens is that you haven't separated the two groups out. You haven't separated the sector and the common pool out. And so what one group does can affect the other. Now, it can actually work both ways. It's entirely possible that the common pool could catch the cod tack too quickly, which would close the eastern U.S. area and prevent sectors from fishing out there. Or the reverse could happen. The sectors could go out there. They've got a cod tack. They could conceivably, though this is open to discussion later about how you deal with the eastern U.S. Canada area, they may have an exemption that allows them to fish in a way that the common pool can't, and then they go out and catch, you know, the total cod cap and prevent the common pool vessels from fishing out there.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Vito?
Generally, we support the motion. I think there's got to have a way to allocate the fish out there and have the incentive for boats to fish in the eastern area under sectors. It really removes much of the appeal of a sector for an offshore vessel to go out there and deal with the current allocation, you know, the current system that we have. That's the whole idea of the eastern area shutting down all the time is because it is an Olympic fishery. You know, so if you're out there with your TAC, you get to fish it the way you want. That's the idea of sectors. As far as the common pool shutting down or the sectors shutting down the common pool, I don't know how that could happen unless, you know, the sectors were allocated enough of the Georges Bank cod that they went beyond some trigger, the 70% or whatever it is, and the input controls change in the eastern area. I suppose that could happen. But other than that, I think, you know, we support the idea of, I think this is the fairest way you could come up with is have, if you get a certain percentage of Georges Bank cod, then you get that percentage of the eastern tack. So, you know, we support this motion.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Dave Cathel.
A question for Pat. I mean, she's opposed to this based on the idea that there'd be 500, potentially 500 individual tacks for the eastern area. I don't have a dog in this fight one way or the other. I'm just trying to figure out what to do. That sounds administratively burdensome, but not doing it also sounds like it could create a whole other set of problems. I want to know why. Are you opposed to it just strictly from the administrative burden, or are some other reasons as well?
It's primarily from the administrative burden perspective, the logistical perspective, that I just don't see how that could work. And maybe when the council talks about monitoring systems, it'll become clearer, but the bottom line is I don't really see how that is feasible. So that's the general.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Twelve in favor, opposed. Three opposed, abstentions. One abstention, motion. Two abstentions, motion carries 12-3-2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are now moving on to sector baseline calculations on page 23. As indicated earlier, we did not have any intention of revisiting the sector baseline alternatives that we put into the document at the January 24th meeting. When Tom and I had worked on these motions, et cetera, we had not had our February 11th meeting this past Monday, and there were some motions that need to be taken up that have to do with some additional tinkering of the baseline calculations. If you go to document number 24, which is a list of motions, the third motion down, I will make this motion on behalf of the committee. For the sector share calculations, the vessel baseline will be fixed at January 29, 2004, for length, horsepower, characteristics, capacity, part of the formula.
Committee motion does not require a second. Tom.
Yeah, just a brief explanation and then a question for the service on this particular motion that I thought of since it was passed. The service needs to know what date. Well, let me back up. Under at least two of the alternatives that are considered for baseline history, they include length, horsepower, and the days allocated under Framework 42. The sector needs to know what date to take a snapshot of the permit database to do those calculations. And what this does is it establishes the date, whatever it is, January 29th, 2004. That's not just a date they pulled out of the air. That's a date that they used to establish baseline characteristics under one of the baseline issues that have come up over the years. So that's a date that's been in place for a while. So basically, they would take a snapshot of the database, and if the capacity alternatives are chosen, one of them, then that's what they use for what length and horsepower is attached to a permit. I do have a question for the service, and that is that something that I don't think we thought of at the meeting Monday is how does that date interact with the hand gear A permits, which are eligible to join sectors? They were not actually, that permit category wasn't authorized till May 1st, 2004. I don't know if they already had a vessel baseline as of January 29th or not.
I'm not sure if we'll get an answer. Maybe it's going to be an outstanding question.
I have no idea what Doug just said, and I'm going to let him.
It's unlikely that those vessels will have a baseline calculated as of January 29, 2004, simply because they weren't a limited access permit at that time. So we'd likely have to calculate that. That said, there's not that many vessels out there, probably a limited pool.
Tom.
Yeah, and depending on a later issue, it may not matter anyway, because that part may be zero for them anyway, because they don't have days at sea. I just remembered that.
Okay, we have a motion on the board. Discussion? Any discussion from the council? Go to the audience. Anything in the audience? Any questions? Eric?
I'm just a little confused about what the actual date represents. Some people have permits on a skiff, for instance, to lease the days to their primary vessel. Does that mean that the skiff length and horsepower will be the baseline, or are we talking about the permit baseline? There's two questions to this. The other one is, you're allowed a 20% increase in horsepower, 10% in length. Some people had used that upgrade by that time. Other people may not have used it. You know, some people may have fixed their permit the next day or the day before. I don't know. So how are upgrades treated? Does this snapshot mean it's the length of the vessel that's in the permit database at that point, or the baseline for the vessel and including upgrades? Just a question about that.
Was there discussion at the committee about that, or does anyone have input? Pat?
Yeah, we're talking about the permit baseline and any upgrades that were done through that date, but not the upgrades that were completed after that date.
To that point, Jim?
Yeah, this doesn't make that vessel ineligible to fish. It's just to use it for a calculation of your quota share. It doesn't change that if you've upgraded now, that doesn't mean that vessel that you upgraded can no longer fish. So I just wanted to throw that up.
You're still in the audience. Vito, then Dave.
We just wanted to point out it's not upgraded. You don't up the way we understand it is the vessel replacement baseline for every permit is what would be the not the leasing baseline or the transfer baseline. It's but the vessel replacement baseline. For many vessels, that's a different baseline than is on the website and a different baseline than the purpose of the January 29, 2004. So just pointing that out, that using January 29, 2004 would be using that base, that control date for something other than what it was originally posted for. So you'd be choosing to use that date to now be a vessel replacement baseline cap in time. We had suggested 96 to 2006, which is the history period, being the period used, so it's the same. You're using it in the first half of the calculation and the second half of the calculation and use that since we're setting a new baseline, a new control date anyway. So there have been vessel baseline corrections is basically what would alter what was in the web in that database. It wouldn't be an upgrade. It would be a vessel baseline correction that could have occurred after January 29th, would not be able to be used in this calculation for allocation as a result of using this older control date that was originally set up for a different reason. It was set up for days at sea transfer and days at sea leasing purposes, not for capping vessel replacement baselines. So it just doesn't really matter to us either way. We're just pointing that out. This is not vessel upgrades or anything like that. It's the vessel replacement baseline.
Pat?
I'm sorry. I actually misspoke. It is the vessel leasing baseline. So it's the baseline that was established for vessel leasing with just the length and horsepower, on January 29th for the purposes of leasing, and that people have been using since as sort of a baseline that does not change and a common currency between all the vessels.
Totally agree with Pat. The thing is, the industry was under the impression it was vessel replacement. If you go back in the transcripts, you'd probably see that was stated many times that when this these capacity options were put forward, it was for a vessel replacement baseline, not for the days of sea leasing or transferring baseline. So now I guess it comes down to the intent of the committee.
David?
Just a question, really. Does all this smoke and mirrors type of stuff go away if you choose the history only you know, for sectors, all this goes away, right? It becomes far less complicated.
I don't think this decision has any bearing if the council ultimately picks a history-only alternative.
Thanks.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further from the council? John Nelson.
Well, not having served on the committee, the point that Pat and Vito were discussing seemed that they were totally opposite points, and there seemed to be industry had a sense of that it was different than what Pat ultimately came up with as far as the leasing issue. So did the committee have that discussion? And was it clear that what Pat described is what the overall intent was of the committee?
I'll ask the chair or the staff or anyone on the committee if they feel that the discussion at the committee meeting answers that question. Anybody? Tom?
Yeah, I got to be honest. I'm thoroughly confused by baselines, so I'm not sure it was clear to me. I don't know about committee members. I mean, the point that I knew was that NIMS wanted to pick a date that they had used in the past where things were fixed. But I'm not sure I understood all the differences between the different baselines.
Pat?
I'm trying to get this straight in my own mind and talking with Doug here. And I don't think that there's a discrepancy here after talking about it a little bit more. It is the leasing baseline, but the leasing baseline is effectively the permit baseline on January 29th. And the only difference would be that the permit baseline now reflects any upgrades that have been approved since then, and the leasing baseline doesn't. So I think on that date they would be one and the same pretty much.
Anything else? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, just to that point, it's the only common currency we have, that on that date everything was fixed, and everybody knew where they stood. You know, things have changed since then because people may have upgraded or whatever, but on January 29th, that was it. You were fixed at that point for your baseline. So you may have upgraded since then. You may have different horsepower or whatever, but the common currency existed on January 29th, 2004.
Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion carries 16-0, one abstention. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have one additional motion under this section. It is motion number 5 on your sheet number 24. And the motion is to allow the closed area 1 hook gear haddock sap landings to be counted in determining potential sector contributions. There are, I think, several issues with this. Tom may correct me on that. If you go back to the discussion that the council had at the time that we worked on this, it was felt that these landings would not count for history. However, I believe that in the regulations, there is no reference to them not counting. And secondarily, in the it's determined that it would be relatively difficult to pull these landings, to separate these landings out of the figures.
That was a committee motion discussion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. John Nelson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Did the committee discuss the very fact, though, that we had a lot of discussion associated when we were setting up SAPs, and it was very clear, and I don't remember the full vote, but I remember the discussion associated with it was very clear that they were not going to be included. in any history for the future. And it just seems like, I realize we can always change our mind, but I didn't get a sense from what Rips used as the rationale for separating those out, not being able to separate them out very, very cleanly, that's a legitimate reason. So I'd like to make sure that if we're going to change what we said we were not going to do, that we have some very solid reasons for not doing that, for changing it.
Anyone else on the committee or the council? Tom?
At the committee meeting, I was asked to be ready today to explain where that decision came from. I don't know if the committee still wants to hear that or not. The decision on the Framework 41 provision not to count the history.
Sure.
First off, the council has never at least put in a document that the history for all SAPs would not count towards any future allocation. The only time this was specifically adopted was in Framework 41, which is the framework action that we passed in order to allow both sector and non-sector vessels into the Closed Area 1 Hook Gear Haddock SAP. When that SAP was originally submitted, the council was going to allow both groups into the SAP. NIMPS disapproved allowing non-sector vessels in, so we had to follow up with an action that would allow them in. And so the concern was raised during the development that there would be some sort of competition or derby between the sector and non-sector vessels as they tried to catch the haddock tack. And there was a view that this was undesirable for a lot of reasons, safety concerns and others. And so the council decided to split the SAP into two different periods. When the council decided to split the SAP into two different periods, they had to figure out what to do with the haddock tack. And so what we did is we divided the haddock tack equally between the two periods, between sector and non-sector vessels. So then the question became, okay, we've divided this tack between the two vessels. Is this a permanent allocation to one group or the other? And the council was saying, no, we want to make it clear that this is not a permanent allocation, that, you know, it's not forever, that the hook gear gets one half of the haddock out of the closed area one haddock SAP. That's how the discussion started. As the discussion went on, that kind of changed to this issue of for future allocation if there are future allocation initiatives for individual vessels, that the history in the SAP will not count towards determining catch history. That's where it came from. But I want to make it clear that was specifically to haddock that was caught in the SAP, and it was specific to this SAP. It wasn't adopted for other SAPs. Now, the reason that seems to have come up from that is because, unlike some other SAPs, this was a SAP. Feeling kind of sappy about time. But anyway, this was a program where, in essence, the council was allocating a certain amount of fish to a specific group of vessels, the Cape Cod hook sector. And they were somewhat concerned that, you know, that in the future would somehow disadvantage or advantage them in calculating possible future sector shares.
Anyone else on the council? Jim Odlin.
Yeah, Tom, now, if we pick the allocation period to be 2000, I think we're talking about 96 to 2006, when did the SAP, when it was the Cape Cod Hook only SAP, what years did that operate? Not all of those years, I don't believe.
No, the SAP was only for the hook sector, I believe, in fishing year 2004. And by fishing year 2005, it was eligible for non-sector participants as well. If you look at catches, the hook sector has probably caught the bulk of the haddock, in part because of that one extra year coming out of that SAP. It's probably not as far apart as I thought it was, except for that one year.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I have a question for Pat. It's been stated here that it would be hard to
to know the amount of fish that were landed from that SAP and to remove them from the allocation? Is that true? I mean, I thought these fish were reported specifically to the SAP.
I don't think it's true to say it would be hard to know. It would be hard to figure it out. It's not that we don't have the information, but it would be very difficult to tease it out.
Okay. And my second comment then would just go to our credibility. I mean, we did very specifically state at that time that this would not be used to obtain history. There are a lot of people that probably did not gear up to go hook fishing in that SAP because the fish they were going to derive from that cost more than the cost of gearing up. Now, because they didn't do that, now they're finding out, I don't get any haddock history potentially in George's Bank. And that may have been far more valuable than the actual fish that they ever landed from that. It may be worth millions of dollars. So, I mean, we don't have much credibility to begin with. And if we pass this, we aren't going to have any. And deservedly so.
Anyone else? Dave Simpson, then Jim Salisbury.
Yeah, again, this is an alternative, right, for Amendment 16, so it's not a final decision.
Jim?
Primarily, I have some questions. It's an alternative to what? Is there a specific alternative in there that says that it will not count, or is that just would go by implication because of what was done in the past? That's one question. I have some others. I mean, it's an alternative, but it's really there's no other alternative, so it's not an alternative. I mean, it's not we're just kind of creating a definition in a sense. So it's really not an alternative. And if that interpretation is incorrect, then maybe somebody can correct it. The other thing is, I can appreciate John Nelson's comments that, you know, we can change at any time our opinion, but it's more difficult when you change that opinion retroactively, what we did and what people operated under, and then you say, no, now that doesn't count anymore. So I think by changing it in a retroactive fashion, it has a somewhat of a different impact than it is if you said, okay, from now on, we're going to let it count. I can appreciate those commitments that we've made, but I have another concern. If people did go in the SAP and they did get those landings, it means they didn't do something else, something that they would have done otherwise. And if they, then what happens? They don't get any landings for a period of time that they would have had landings someplace else. So I find it difficult to say, well, you know, if you did something and as Dave said, you geared up and you went out and fished for something that was less valuable than the cost of doing it, and you did all this, but you not only lost that value, but you lost anything that you would have done otherwise. So I find it particularly difficult for us not to go forward and approve this motion. I don't like the idea that we change it and that we sort of shift the rules around for what counts in the past, but we also have to realize that if you don't do this, you really take away from people something that they would have done something otherwise, and we've now eliminated that. So that, I guess I would vote for the motion.
Jim Mullen.
Yes. To be honest with you, I originally opposed this motion in the committee, but I've just thought of something that will change my mind, and I will support the motion, and that is that if we have this as an option in this document, that means that all 19 sectors have to somehow figure out their share of the landings two different ways, times 19, because, and I don't know, I agree with Pat, I don't know how NIMS is going to give that availability to them, because the any of the options we pick on sector on shares has to do with your share of the landings over a period of time. Now, if we don't include this, we have to go back in and take it out, that share of the landings,
and it changes everybody's share of the landings across 19 different sectors. I think I'm explaining it right. Doug's shaking his head, so I must be. And so for that reason, I will change my opinion on this. And although I, too, don't like changing our policy, but this is kind of a unique situation. So I think we need to support this and move it forward. It's not. I don't believe it's going to be that much fish.
Anyone else on the council? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fourteen opposed. One abstentions. Two. Motion carries 14-1, two abstentions. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are now going to move off of the motions on document number 24. We will go back to the motions on the on page number 3 of the handout that you received. We are under transfer of catch entitlement, which relates to page 24 in document number 1. On behalf of the committee, I would make the motion to include as an amendment 16 alternative, the provisions for transfer of annual catch entitlement as described in the Amendment 16 Draft Sector Management Measures document dated January 31, 2008.
Committee motion does not require second. Discussion from the council.
Tom has some comment.
Tom Neese.
If I could back up for just a second, just to make it clear on the record that the committee clarified by consensus that when in the two capacity formulas, that when they're talking about days at sea in the capacity formula, they mean the baseline days at sea allocated to a permit, not including carryover or any adjustment for large mesh days at sea. So just to make that clear so that everyone understands what day at sea number is being used. We did have a little confusion on Amendment 13 because we got a little sloppy in describing an alternative. So the committee wanted to clarify that in those capacity alternative versions that have days at sea, it means the baseline approved by Framework 42 without carryover, without any large mess adjustment. So it's the basic baseline allocation. With respect to this particular provision, there are two elements to this. The general concept is that sectors can freely trade their annual catch entitlement between each other. This makes it easier for sectors to adjust their catches and to get to adjust their ACE to match what their catches may turn out to be to allow for unforeseen circumstances. We're not putting any restrictions on the transfer. A sector does not have to transfer unused ACE to someone if they don't want to. If there's some sort of agreement between the sectors, whether monetary or otherwise, that's between the sectors. The other provision that's in here is that we promote allowing the sectors to transfer, we're calling it a transfer, but they allow to carry up to 10% of their unused ACE into the next fishing year. Now, there's a couple issues here that just to highlight. The transfer of ACE is proposed to be allowed at any time during the fishing year and up to 2 weeks into the next fishing year. The idea here is that we're trying to give sectors a chance to balance the books before they wind up getting penalized for exceeding the ACE. That's why we allow that to go into the next fishing year. Now, this isn't a blanket for opportunity for sectors to exceed their ACE. If they get up to their ACE or think they're going over it, they have to stop fishing in the year, and they can't start fishing again until they acquire ACE from another sector. But it's intended to give them a chance. Allowing it to go in all through the year allows them to do it at any time, obviously, particularly at the end of the year where they may need to do this quota balancing.
We'd also point out that in many other similar programs throughout the world, these provisions tend to be relatively standard, that there's some provision that allows carryover of an amount, not unlimited, into the next year, and that generally the transfers are allowed to take place in many of these types of programs.
Tom, if I could just ask you, for the benefit of people in the audience, we're using a term ACE that some people may not be familiar with. And in fact, when we tend to use ACT, ACL, OFL, ACE, so on and so forth, that probably would be helpful for the audience if we use the words for a little while and let people get comfortable, at least at the beginning of a discussion during the day. I've had a couple of people in the audience comment to me that, especially yesterday with the discussion on ACLs, it got very soupy, alphabet soupy. So, but if you could just explain ACE briefly, Tom.
Sure. We have a calculation for each permit where you get a potential sector contribution, and that's a percentage. When a permit joins a sector, the sector gets the sum of all the permits that join and gets the potential sector contribution total. It just adds up. That's still a percentage. At some point, we take that percentage and multiply it by the available catch, either, not to use more acronyms, but annual catch limit or target TAC, whatever you want to call it. We multiply it by the annual catch, and it becomes a pound value that a sector can harvest in any particular year. That's what we're calling the annual catch entitlement, or ACE. So the sector share, if the participants in a sector stay the same, the sector share would probably stay the same from year to year unless there was some sort of correction or penalty. How many pounds of fish they get each year would go up or down based on how much fish is available to be harvested. And that's what we call the ACE. So what we're allowing the people to trade back and forth is their pounds on an annual basis. They're not allowed to change. My sector can't say, I'm going to permanently give your sector 10% of my ACE, and you've got that 10% into the future. All we're saying is, yeah, I'll sell you or I'll loan you 1 million pounds of George's Bank haddock this year.
Thanks, Tom. Council, Frank Blount, then Dr. Pierce.
Yeah. I have absolutely no problem with transferring of the fish during the year to balance the books and do that. I'm a little concerned with the carryover. And if you can carry over, probably a question to Tom, if people carry over 10%, is that going to lower the ACL for next year for everybody else?
Well, this is an issue that was, this kind of highlights a fundamental question, and that is, can you carry over an available catch from one year to the next without impacts on mortality? And my answer to that is, well, it kind of depends. If you set your catch exactly at your limit of catch, you know, take your fishing mortality rate, multiply it by your stock size, and you set your catch at that level. The answer to that question is no, because the fish, you can't carry fish forward from one year to the next and assume it's a mortality wash. It depends on how fast the fish grow, what the stock looks like. And the PDT did some examples for the committee that illustrated that through projections. We showed that, you know, just because you're under your fishing mortality rate this year because you caught less than your target, that doesn't mean you're going to be, you know, that could mean you're going to be over next year. You can't just move pounds forward. It doesn't work that way. And, you know, part of the reason is because you have natural mortality going on, but there are other reasons. You may have weak or strong year classes, and it could screw things up. How that relates into the ACL is a good question that I'm not quite sure I know the answer to. I mean, I think if you have an ACL and you specify those in advance, on the surface I'd say, well, you know, if you don't catch 10% of your ACL this year, it doesn't automatically mean it's available the next year or the exact amount. You know, you could say, okay, well, what I'll do is the part of the ACL that I don't catch this year, I'm going to move forward into next year. Well, then you run into that problem that I just talked about, which has not been thoroughly, potentially run into the problem I just talked about, which has not been thoroughly explored about, you know, how does that relate to your mortality targets? You know, it is possible that you could find a number, I don't know what it is, and reduce what you give to the sectors this year so that you allow them to carry over something into the next year if they need to. I don't know if that's desirable to the industry or not. You know, yes, it gives them the flexibility that if they don't catch all of their ACE, they might be able to catch it the following year. But, you know, on the other hand, then they're sacrificing something this year that they may or may not get back completely. So, you know, I don't know how they would value that idea.
All right, Dr. Pierce, then Jim Odlum.
I support the transfer provision. However, the second part of it's not really on the screen, that in the text in the text on page 24 that describes transfer of annual catch entitlements is a bit confusing to me, and I'd appreciate it if a committee member could elaborate a bit. And my first question is, the exchange of ACE between two sectors is viewed as a private business arrangement. Why did the committee conclude that that is the appropriate way to describe that kind of an exchange? In addition, when it says sectors can seek compensation, monetary or otherwise, I would appreciate it if the otherwise could be clarified. What other sorts of compensation is being considered? This is very shadowy. And that's always bothered me about being so liberal with sectors that they can do pretty much they want to do behind the scene, and we don't really know what's going on. Some would argue it's none of our business anymore once this fish is allocated to a given sector, but I say, no, it is our business. We always have to deal with socioeconomic impacts. We always have to deal with questions posed by the fishing industry regarding such things as what's going on in that sector. That's a question that might be posed by the many vessels that would be in the common pool. We're obligated to provide as much information to that segment of the public we needed to answer those particular questions posed by that segment of the public. So, again, why the reference to it as a private business arrangement? And give me some examples of otherwise.
Go to Rip, then Tom.
Well, the fact that it is a private business transaction, I think, is one of the reasons that we're going to sectors. I mean, they have, you know, private business arrangements with the participants in the sector. As far as something other than monetary, it could be trading of other fish. In other words, you've got species X for species Y. That's non-monetary in that sense. Obviously, at some point in time, it turns into money because that's what the ultimate basis of all of this is. But it could be something else. But again, I don't. This is one that I don't believe. We don't ask them to, you know, explain to us their individual contracts with every single one of their participants. So why would we be saying you have to tell us how much you pay for these fish or what it is, what you're trading for this and that? Ultimately at the end of the year, the sector manager has got certain reporting requirements that will be necessitated by their operations plan, and that's between the sectors and the service.
If I may, I disagree with that perspective. I think we all need to understand the dynamics of sectors, especially what goes on between sectors. And I would move, Mr. Chairman, to add another sentence to the language shown on page 24. And that would be after the sentence that reads, sectors are not obligated to transfer unused ACE to a sector that needs additional ACE, I would add the sentence, details, parentheses, including types of compensation, close parentheses, of transfer of ACE to other sectors must be reported in sector annual reports.
Motion to amend. Is there a seconder? Seconded by John Nelson. I have a question actually for the service. I know this is what we're discussing, but I would imagine that you would require, if all this goes forward, you would require a sector to notify you that it had taken a lease or some other arrangement of ACE from another sector in a given fishing year. Is that right?
Right. They'd still have to report to us.
Discussion on the amendment. Also, just to remind the council, it's been said several times through other motions that these are alternatives or options that we're putting into the document. These aren't the final decisions. Rodney?
Yeah, I know there are alternatives, but we're just piling that paper up here. Pretty soon, Dr. Pierce is going to ask me for my marriage certificates here. And I can see I'm not going to join the sector. I mean, it's getting more and more complicated. We went down the sector road to make this easier for the industry. And now we're just piling it on and on and on.
Anyone else on the council? John Nelson.
I thought. I thought that Rodney already had his own sector for wives, but he certainly has his own sector for alimony, anyways. Mr. Chairman, I don't see this as a burden to the industry, and I do appreciate the amount of information that is a concern of reporting. But I think we just heard from Pat that they're going to report what they did. If you're filing, and this is just now, this is all we're saying is that in the annual report, present that same information of what you already provided to the service. I mean, that's basically all you're looking at. It's probably going to be a couple of sentences or a quick paragraph. But I think that the sectors have a responsibility to provide an accounting to the council in their annual report about, well, okay, this is what we did, and here's how it went, and this is the interaction we had with the other sectors. If you don't do that, then those questions will come up at the council when they review those annual reports. So you may as well stick it in there because it's part of the public record already, and just be done with it. It doesn't mean that that's something burdensome. And maybe one of the wives is a good secretary, and they can type it out quickly.
Paul Howard.
One of the things on the carryover is I was wondering if, say, after 2 years we're on a biennial assessment, and after year two, one sector wants to carry over 10%, but after the assessment, in years 3 and 4, we have to take a 5% decrease or a 5% increase, then how do you address the 10% carryover? I mean, that would all have to be in here.
Council? Go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Is that Maggie?
I'm Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. This particular motion doesn't have anything to do with the carry forward, does it? No. Okay. All right. People keep referring to it, and I'm getting very confused. Regarding the details of the compensation, since 2004, every council meeting, Pat Kirkel reports on to you the average cost of days at sea leasing. Does that mean anything to anybody? Does that provide any information to you? Does that inform you in any way about the days at sea leasing program?
Pat?
In response to that, although the council, and I've wondered about this too, when I give my report and people seem to be glazing over, I don't think the council is getting any benefit from it. In fact, we do use it in the economic analyses we do.
I'm looking at the document that's referenced in the motion, and the very first line of Section H4 says a sector can carry up to 10% of unused ACE forward into the next fishing year. So I think I want to know from the chair of the committee whether or not it does contain the 10% carryover provision. Right. The amendment has nothing to do with the carryover. Okay. So once we dispense with that, I'll ask my question again. Anyone else in the audience on the amendment? Back to the council. Anything further? Ready for the question on the motion to amend? All those in favor? Seven opposed. Ten. The motion to amend fails. 7-10. Okay, back on my question.
The answer is yes. It does include the 10% carryover, annual carryover.
Just to be clear. Jim Audlin.
Yes, I'd like to discuss the carryover and how its benefits, I guess, as I see them. If somebody's getting up against the ACE of a particular item, they've caught 95%. If they can carry it over, they probably won't go back out fishing. You know, similar to the days at sea thing. So you eliminate a safety issue. So if they think they're going to lose it, they're going to go no matter what. The other issue is if they go back out and if you don't let them carry it over, they'll go back out. And maybe 5% isn't enough. Maybe they make a mistake, and all of a sudden they caught an extra 5%. I submit that that is going to cause people to do something we don't want to encourage them to do. And by not pushing them up against the line every year, it's safer, and it's easier for them to sit back and be more controlled. And it will benefit the industry, and it will benefit the resource in the long run. As far as how you take a 5% reduction the following year, the carryover has nothing to do with your next year's allocation. You're not allocating them. You're not going to be telling them now you have a 5% reduction. You're going to be telling them we're reducing the ACL by 2,000 tons. So that's the reduction. And they're getting their fixed percentage of that 2,000 tons the following year. Not you're not reducing it by you may be reducing it by a percentage, but it's now turned into a poundage thing that you're reducing the ACE by. So I don't think that the two are the same. I think they're different. So I support the carryover for both safety and practical reasons.
Dave Simpson, then Sally McGee, then Rodney.
Okay, I guess I just still have a question about this, and based on, you know, both what was said and my understanding of assessments and allocations in the subsequent year, those fish may not be there next year, and I guess what it comes down to is in the assessment and in the calculation of overall TAC for the next year. If it's already been assumed that the entire TAC from the previous year will have been caught, if that has been assumed, then I think he's right that you could carry it forward a year. Beyond a year, I'd be very concerned, because you get into that scallop situation where 6 years down the road, somebody wants to harvest scallops that we figured out never existed. So if in the assessment it's presumed that everyone took 100%, then I think we're okay. But if it's not, then we do have a problem carrying it forward.
Sally?
Yeah, I think a lot of this discussion has illustrated the potential problems with a 10% carry forward alternative. I was going to offer a motion to split the question so we could be considering the carry forward and the the two-week grace period separately. I'm going to leave it for now since we're in the early stages of considering alternatives. But as far as the safety and flexibility at the end of the fishing year, both of these ways of treating transfer of annual catch entitlements allow for flexibility at the end of the fishing year. So if a sector wants to fish right up to their ACL and take the risk of exceeding it by a bit at the end of the fishing year, they can do that with the understanding that they have 2 weeks after the end of the fishing year to balance the books. And I think that's the point here with catch limits is balancing the books. With the 10% carry forward, it's not clear how or when the books ever do get balanced. So, you know, these two ways of dealing with how people are able to and encouraged to fish up to their catch limit can have the same effect, but one, actually, you do balance the books. The other, with the 10% carry forward, it's entirely unclear, I think, from this discussion, when you ever actually do that.
Okay, Rodney, then Pat Kirkle.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Odlin hit on a lot of the points I was going to hit, but the safety issue is one that I'm very concerned with, and the other one is that it allows fishermen to fish responsibly. Rather than going out and make that trip when you might have 6% of your catch left to catch, you'll say, well, I can carry it over. And if everybody's worried about the deduction of the next year doesn't come off your carryover. It comes off what you got, your quota, your ACL or whatever it is. That's what it comes off. It's not what you're carrying over. It comes off of that before you even carry it over. So it's going to balance out. Thank you.
Pat Kirkle.
Well, I have problems with both of the proposals, the carryover as well as the 2 weeks into the fishing year that you can still transfer your allocation. On the carryover part of it, I just can't support it until I see how it's going to work, until, in fact, I have some appreciation for how the council still proposes to stay within their mortality targets in the following year, given the possibility of a carryover. So I think the council needs to figure that out before I could support this. On the two-week issue, right now we cut off leasing on March 1st, and that's so that at the end of the year, we know exactly where we are. It allows for that a break in the process so that we can, for counting purposes, basically. If we go 2 weeks into the next fishing year and still allow these transfers, then I'm not clear how it will work because people won't know what their sector allocations are until all that accounting has taken place. So, you know, there's, again, I certainly see the benefits of both of them, but I just don't see how they would work. And is it okay for a sector not to know perhaps for a month or two into the next fishing year what their allocation is for that fishing year? I don't know. I mean, someone needs to tell me that. And I keep hearing that they do this all around the world in terms of the overage part of it, and this accounting, this kind of accounting process. But you're talking about ITQ systems, not sectors, and there is a difference between them. There's a very fundamental difference between them. And under ITQ system, there's a lot more responsibility on the individual, and so you can have a different type of accounting system. So that's my
I had John Nelson and Jim Salisbury.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I was trying to remember again what our policy was on this, and I wondered if the committee looked at the policy. Finally, I think I remember it, and it is that We were not allocating any unused portion to the following fishing year. Now, if the committee discussed it from that standpoint of, well, trying to balance books, et cetera, you know, and they want to use it from that standpoint, I think that's fine. But we were not adding an unused portion to an allocation for the coming year. And conversely, if you went over, you were subtracting it off the coming year's allocation. So again, if we're going to change the policy, we need to deal with it on a policy level. I don't think that was the intent here. I think it's trying to, you know, just account for things in a timely manner. But I would also, I guess, kind of echo what Pat was saying. If you've got a sector which is supposed to be well run, you know what your catch is. You're not going to send a horde of people out, you know, at the last week and say, oh, you've got only 6% left, and you know that they can catch, you know, 20% and with that fishing power. You're not going to send them all out. You know, you're going to make that decision. You want to catch your quota, and I'm not trying to throw a monkey wrench in that, but I think that people have to plan accordingly, and I am willing to give them a couple weeks to take care of it. But I would think that they would have planned very carefully and have made sure that they were pretty well topped off just before that year was going to end. But as far as for carryover unlimited for the following year, I think that's not what the policy calls for.
All right. There's been a question as to the policy, the sector policy. Rip, you have it in front of you. And then Tom Neese, and then Jim Sells.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the existing sector policy, it doesn't get to your specific point, John. It does indicate that if a sector transfers a portion of its TAC to another sector, then exceeds its remaining portion, the transferred portion is not affected, but the sector would have its TAC reduced proportionally for the following year by the amount of the overage. But it doesn't indicate that they couldn't go out and get TAC to offset that overage.
Tommy's.
Yeah, I don't believe there's anything in the sector policy, looking at it in front of me, that specifically addresses carryover. I think it's silent on the issue.
Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. One, I think I understood Tom's explanation of why a carryover from one year to the other didn't necessarily translate into you can do this without any impact on future fishing mortality decisions. What I didn't understand is he said, well, you could perhaps reduce the ACL for the year in anticipation of some carryover, and that might make it allowable. But I don't understand why reducing the ACL for the year makes it any different. It's just you're just starting from a little lower number or a little bigger gap, but it really doesn't make the phenomenon any different, if I understand him correctly. Could you explain that to me, please? And then I have one more question as well. It's related.
Well, I'll try, and I think maybe I tripped over acronyms here. You can't carry over uncaught fish from one year, one for one, into the next year, and expect that your fishing mortality rates are going to be exactly what you designed to do. What I was suggesting is that if you planned to catch less in one year so that you had a buffer between, I should say less in one year, but less in every year, so that you've got a buffer between what you catch and what fishing mortality result you're trying to achieve, well, then you may have enough of a buffer built in there so that if you carry over a little bit from one year to the next, you're still within a buffer. How that fits into the ACL framework, though, where we specify annual catch limits ahead of time, I think starts to get complicated. And that's where I was saying where, you know, you might have to write something that says, well, here's my ACL, an unused fish gets carried over into the next ACL so that you don't bump into that ACL limit. I'm not sure you could do that. I'm just speculating that you might have to do something like that.
Thank you. Then I see what you're getting at. The other question was related to Dave Simpson's comment that if you assume that the entire ACL is going to be caught in 1 year, then in effect you've taken account of that mortality, and then you can go on to the next year without you could carry it over to the next year without having any impact on it. And it seems to me that that might not be a valuable thing to do, because you're then going to assume that there's going to be a 10% carryover every year, and in effect you're reducing or you're calculating that impact in the following year, and if it doesn't happen, you've lost from the following year in effect for what you're assuming is going to happen. And additionally, it seems to cause the same problems I think Pat was talking about with the weekly. When do you figure this all out so people can know what's going to happen? You know, all these things are going to happen right at the very last weeks of the fishery, but it's the very first weeks of the next one, and you don't know what really happened. So how is this going to translate into a practical method of doing it? If I understand those Dave's suggestion clearly, and I may not, but if I understand that, then it seems to me that one of the benefits you get with a sector is that you can trade, you can do things to organize your year effectively, and that's the way you get to the end without having lost fish or having lost opportunity to fish, and you traded right up to the end and you managed it. But, you know, as much as I like the idea that you can have a little slush fund there and go a little over, a little under, and no harm done, I think that the real mechanism of the sector is that the sector manages that, and they got to try to do it. And if they can't do it, I'm not sure within another 2 weeks they can do it better or by giving them a 10% leeway that they're going to make their problem less. I think they're going to actually make their problem worse. They're going to have the same problem next year, only with less fish to do it with, in anticipation of the fact that this 10% withdrawn. So I'm starting to get troubled by the carryover provisions. And I would be anxious to hear a little more, maybe someone like Pat, a little more show me how this works before I think that I believe that it will work that way. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Dave Gaethel, then Rodney.
Yeah. Pat said one thing I definitely agree with. This isn't an ITQ system. It's far more complex. And I've, you know, I've been to New Zealand. I've studied their ITQ system. And they can't, after 20 years, balance the books at the end of the fishing year. They just can't do it. The fastest they can do it with a private entity that does nothing but balance the books is 48 hours. You have to, there has to be some real a sense of what's realistic here. And, you know, whether it's 10% in 2 weeks or it's 5% in 1 week, I don't know what the exact numbers are. But, again, I get back to what I've been saying right along. We're trying to build a cart here. Now we're arguing about whether we want a 32-ball bearing wheel bearing or a 64-ball bearing wheel bearing. But I guarantee you we're going to be back working on the cart before the wheel ever falls off because the bearings froze up. So I think we ought to just put something in here, move it on, let's try it out. And if we don't like it, if 10% is too big and 2 weeks is too long, we can go back and change it in the future. But I guarantee you, you're not going to be able to do this in real time. I absolutely guarantee it. If people have been doing it for 20 years can't do it, I don't see how we're going to do it on the first shot. So I think we need some degree of realism here in what you expect out of people.
I'm not sure it's entirely analogous, but I know in the Maritimes, DFO withholds a percentage of the allocation until it balances the books, and then it releases the rest of the quota. I mean, that might be something the committee or the council wants to consider to answer one of Pat's questions about what's the mechanism. But, again, I'm not sure it's completely analogous. Paul Howard?
I was just going to say, I think the issue here is unless Tom has the answers, you know, I mean, if you're going to carry over 10% and you've got an ACL in year three, that the ACL goes up or down, how are we going to handle that? And maybe I'm missing it, but if Tom knows how, then I think we can move on. But I don't know how the service can approve anything if we don't know how it's going to work when you have that third year. You're going up and down as it compares to an ACL. And I'm not convinced I know, but if Tom does, then.
Well, I'm not convinced I know, but I would point out that in some of these programs, they write in limits on when these carryovers can take place. And, for example, if the quota is, I believe one of them is along the lines of, if the quota is scheduled to go down from one year to the next, then carryover is not allowed. You know, they preclude that option when the quota goes down, and maybe it has to decline a certain amount. But, you know, some of those, clearly those issues, I think, from the services questions are going to have to be delineated a little more detail than they are at present.
Anyone else on the council? Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You read my mind. That's what I was going to say is, before you allocate the next year, you could probably allocate 50% till they come up with that two-week catch-up and then go from there on. That's one way of doing it. The second thing is planning. There's nobody I know that's going to plan how much fish they're going to catch. I made a couple of fishing trips in my life, and I always planned when I left the dock to come back with a boat full. And there was very little times that I came back that way. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Jim?
The question is this. This is an alternative again. We're getting into that alternative. But the alternative to this is basically no transfer. I mean, it's a status quo. Is that the idea? Is that, you know, it's just basically status quo with no transfer capability and the exchange between sectors is allowed. Is that it is not allowed now? So this is a
currently
a
not
complete
allowed
alternative of those two concepts. Okay, thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Maggie.
Thank you, Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. As has been said all day today, these are just alternatives. We don't have the answer to the questions today on how these things will work. But if you don't advance it, we will never have the answer to how it might work. I'll just leave it at that. I really think both of these kinds of mechanisms are essential to making this work, and I urge you to move them forward, and we'll continue to work to try to figure out how to make them work. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. And Dana, 14. 14 in favor, opposed? 3 opposed. The motion carries 14 to 3. We're going to break for lunch right here. Be back at 1:30.